Let's not strip me of the razor.
So, thanks. Thanks for having me here for listening to this talk. So, in the last decade or so, there's been a radical change in the way we, as observers, provide information to try and reconstruct how galaxies form in the universe. Not so long ago, all we could do was take a picture, or something better, of a galaxy in the local universe, and try to use what they call the fossil evidence to reconstruct its past history. In the last decade or so, thanks to HST, all the fantastic satellites and ground-based telescopes, what we can do is you can actually go out at high redshift and study how galaxies were billions of years ago. And so we can see galaxy formation live in action. Of course, I'll be talking mostly about spheroids, that is, these early-type galaxies, ellipticals, lenticulars, and bulge-dominated spirals. Of course, this is challenging. So here you see on the left a picture of an elliptical galaxy in the Coma cluster. And these are galaxies from Goode, which is pretty much as good as it gets, and between redshift 0.5 and 1, so 5 to 8 billion years away. And you can see, although the scale here is 3 arc minutes, and each of these postage stamps is 3 arc seconds, there's still quite a lot of information left in these images. And I would like you to go away with the idea that not only we can count these objects, measure their properties like luminosity and color, but we can also do some pretty detailed physical measurements on these distant objects. So the purpose of my talk is to illustrate sort of an overview of what I think it's possible to do on distant galaxies out to redshift 1. I won't be giving many details, so just an overview. Please ask me if you want more details. So this is the structure of my talk. First, a very brief introduction. I think everybody here is quite familiar with the subject of the introduction. And then I will describe three particular aspects of understanding from an observational point of view high redshift early type galaxies. First of all is, what do we know about the dark matter halos? Probably none of you would be surprised to learn that galaxies live in dark matter halos at high redshift, but we don't have much observational proof of that. Second point is, what is the relationship between luminous and dark matter? What is stellar mass forming to halos? And the third is, when do supermassive black holes that we believe live inside any spheroid form in the universe, in the universe? So I would give you some observational results on each of these three subjects and try to give some conclusions on each of them. So this is just a simple slide to recap how we think galaxies form in the universe. So there's dark matter, galaxies form inside these dark matter halos, structure evolved to gravity and all that. And the main point is that I would like to take away from this slide is that for a variety of reasons, we believe that star formation and galaxy formation is anticipated in high-density regions. And some mechanism in high-density regions suppresses star formation earlier than in the field. And so a general prediction, at least a few years ago in hierarchical models, was that, for example, early-type galaxies were younger in the field than in cluster. And probably nobody is, this is not news to anybody, but one of the basic ideas of this kind of models is that massive galaxies like early-type galaxies form by mergers of spirals. So first you form disks, then they merge and form more massive galaxies like spheroids. And so I think simulations have become pretty ambitious nowadays. This is a nice piece of work by Metz and collaborators, when they simulate in quite a bit of detail the formation of an elliptical galaxy. And you see there's a merger, and the color codes the stellar ages, and then it starts age and evolve until you get to something that looks like a local elliptical galaxy. And they could do plots of dark matter halo, mass in stars, mass in gas, right? And they can predict start from mass assembly rate, they can construct a rotation curve in the local universe. So I think we are reaching the point where theoretical models can do quite detailed predictions of the internal structure of high redshift galaxies. But this is very difficult, of course. There's lots of unknown physics that goes into this, and it's very difficult, I think, from a computational point of view as well. So the other aspect of this problem is that what is the connection between black holes and spheroids? So we know empirically that mass, every spheroidal galaxy hosts a supermassive black hole at the center. And the mass of the supermassive black hole correlates very well with the velocity dispersion of the host spheroid. This is from Terrazian merit. And you see that the correlation is incredibly good. There's almost no room for internal scattering in this correlation. In some magical way, black holes at the center of galaxies know about the mass of the galaxy and vice versa. And you can try and reproduce this with models. This is, for example, by voluntary collaborators, where they do form these black holes at very high redshift and then evolve them. And they can sort of reproduce the local relation. But of course, there's lots of physics to be understood if we can understand exactly all of this comes together. So from the local universe, the so-called fossil evidence, what we know about early type galaxies is that most of the stars are old, and almost inexplicably, their color, mass-light ratio, metallicity, black hole mass, all correlate with velocity dispersion. This is a very tight and very, I think, remarkable. And in any given mass or velocity dispersion, lots of, say, properties related to star formation history and so on, are very tightly determined. And from the local universe, we can tell practically no difference between the scanning laws of early type galaxies and the clustering. I argue that going to high redshift back in time, we can sort of see how this comes together and try to understand how all of this is formed. So let's move on to the first topic, which is dark halos. So in the local universe, we know, at least for some early type galaxies, that they do have dark matter halos. This is very difficult to do because in spirals, you have H1 gas with very large radii, and this demonstrates via dynamical arguments that there is something else other than the baryonic mass. You can do a similar job with early type galaxies, although it's more difficult because you don't have dynamical traces at large radii often. And what people find typically is that at least for some early type galaxies, you have to admit that there's a dark matter halo, and they have sort of equivalent flat rotation curves at large radii. And this is sort of state-of-the-art from Gerard et al. Other method includes, for example, using planetary nebulae or globular clusters at large radii as kinematic tracers, or X-ray, for example, to trace the mass of the halo. And the problem with all these methods is that we cannot apply them in high redshift. We have to come up with something different. So how can we do this at high redshift? Well, the beauty of going at high redshift is that some of ellipticals are gravitational lenses. So we lose information that comes from the traditional tracers, but we gain information coming from gravitational lenses. So this is your typical average Joe lens. It's an elliptical galaxy forming four images of a background galaxy. And the geometry of the lens configuration tells you the total mass enclosed in the cylinder defined by the gravitational curve. And typically, this critical curve is bigger than the effective radius. So you have a mass tracer at large radii that is exquisite because it does not depend on the kinematic state of your mass. Just measure the total mass in the cylinder. And then you have stars in the center, which you can use to trace the potential in the center. And you do this by measuring the motions of these stars. So if you combine dynamical arguments with gravitational lensing arguments, you obtain mass traces at different radii, which is exactly what you want in order to reconstruct the mass density profile of these objects. And this is what we've done in collaboration with Leon Koopmans, now happily in the Netherlands. And we've taken all the existing early type galaxies, gravitational lenses that are suitable for this kind of business. We want objects that are lensing faint galaxies in the background, because we don't want to be completely overwhelmed by the luminosity of the background quasar. So there's only 11 of them known to man today. And what we did is we went to Keck, and we were very lucky. We got very good seeing, typically. And so we took very long observations with very good spectrographs at Keck and completed a kinematic survey of all of these lenses. Now I'll show you the results from the first half of the sample, which is the high redshift half, 0.5 and above. This is for you to familiarize with the phone numbers of these objects, 0047 and 2016, and this three here. And you can see the beautiful gravitational lenses, typical elliptical, with a quad, another quad, blah, blah, so on. And that's it. Sorry. So what we do is we have to use these two constraints that we have, the lensing and dynamics, but we also have another constraint, that is the fundamental plane. So we know that in the local universe, elliptical galaxies obey one of these laws that is called the fundamental plane, that is the size, velocity, dispersion, and surface brightness of elliptical galaxies are not randomly related one to each other, but they obey this tight correlation. And if we study how this evolves with time, and we assume that galaxies lie on this fundamental plane at any given redshift, we can use this fact to compute what the expected stellar mass-to-light ratio would be at any given redshift. So I won't go into any details of this, but you know, feel free to ask if you want. So we have these three weapons, fundamental plane, gravitational lensing, and dynamics. And this is the kind of data we get. So this is 1 second of arc. This is the lens. And 6 hours of integration at Keck give you these boxes here. This is sort of velocity dispersion profile. There's no rotation detected, so it's purely pressure-supported system. And this goes out to about more than 1 arc second. And the effective radius is about here. So you have a dynamical tracer that goes well beyond the effective radius. And the Einstein radius is more or less here. So you have a nice match between velocity dispersion profile and your gravitational lensing point. And you can see immediately from these 3 points that are plotted here, what is the effect of having a lens normalization at high redshift, at a large radii. So these squares here are a constant mass-to-light ratio model. So if you have a constant mass-to-light ratio model, you know how mass is distributed inside your lens. You fix the normalization at the Einstein radius here, and then you have to go up with your velocity dispersion. And that's what you get. You can, I think, these two are two different anisotropy models. When you compute your velocity dispersion profile, you have to assume something about the pressure tensor. These are two different assumptions. But there's no way you can get this all the way down to here. These circles here are just a logarithmic potential, that is a flat rotation curve, in which is embedded a luminous tracer that follows light. All right? So this is almost a perfect match. And you can do this more rigorously, building two-component mass models, where there is a luminous component that follows light and a dark matter halo, and trying to construct a mass density profile. This is, for example, what you get for 0047. These are the two relevant parameters of the problem. This is the stellar mass-to-light ratio, how much mass you attach to each point of light. And this is the slope of the dark matter halo. Dark matter halo in this regime can be, we think, described by a simple power law, because you're inside the break radius of an NFW here. And you see you're seeing this kind of constraints here. The shaded curves include the fundamental plane constraint. You obtain a very tight determination of the stellar mass-to-light ratio and some upper limit on the slope of dark matter halo. And this is done for two different pressure tensor anisotropies. And you can also, if you simplify your model in some sense, you can also obtain some limits on the anisotropy of the pressure tensor. This graph here is telling you that in the central region of the galaxy, the pressure tensor has to be isotropic. You can have some radial anisotropy outside some radius, which is about the effective radius, but not inside. So inside, stellar orbits must be isotropic. And the other thing that you can learn from this plot is that this stellar mass-to-light ratio is much smaller than the mass-to-light ratio you get from aperture. So you take your lensing aperture, you measure the light inside of that, and you have a total mass-to-light ratio inside that aperture. The stellar component is less massive than that, which proves that there is something else, dark matter, something that is not distributed like the light. And you can obtain, for these 5 lenses, the best fitting mass density profiles that are shown here. So this is your luminous component, which dominates inside, say, 1 kiloparsec or so, or 5 or 10. And this is the dark matter halo, all right? So there's a luminous component that dominates in the center, and then there's a flatter component that we call the dark matter halo that takes over at about 10 kiloparsecs or so in density. And the other remarkable thing is that if you add up the two components and you look at the total mass distribution, which is the black line, these look very similar to singularized thermospheres. So density goes as r to the minus 2. So for some reason, luminous and dark matter talk to each other to form something that is close to a singularized thermosphere, flat rotation curve. This is similar to the halo disk conspiracy in spiral galaxies when you see the flat rotation curves with the two different components. So the four main results here are that you can rule out to high level of significance the constant mass ratio, so you detect dark matter halos for real. So this is a proof that they are there. The orbits cannot be too far from isotropic. They have to be isotropic in the center. You get approximately flat rotation curve, and there's some mysterious mechanism that does this for you.
So that is the blue line is a slope of 1, maybe not a diagonal.
Yeah, exactly.
And in the previous plot, you've shown that the contour were compatible with 0 and to 1.5.
Exactly.
So how...
This is the best state model. You don't get such a tight constraint in the slope. You just get an upper limit because you're dominated by stellar mass in the center. And so you don't have that much leverage on that. But you have a pretty good determination of the total slope, and that turns out to be almost equal to 2. And I'll give you some numbers on that. So, all right, so the first thing you can look at is how does a stellar mass to-light ratio compare to what we expect it should be? And this is a plot of mass to light ratio versus redshift for these 5 points. And this is taking the local early type galaxy mass to light ratio and evolving it back in time according to the kind of evolution you measure from the fundamental plane. These constraints here do not include the fundamental plane point. And what you see is that everything behaves like an old stellar population, so passive evolution of an old stellar population. The other point is this. So this gamma prime parameter is the sort of the total average slope or the total mass density profile between, say, 0 and the Einstein radius. And so it's 2 for an isothermal sphere. And if it's below that, it's slightly flatter, so your rotation curve will be rising. And if it's above 2, it will be declining. And you see 2 would be the isothermal sphere, and you are almost around 2. So this is, I think, it's remarkable from the point of view of conspiracy between the two components. But if you wanted to use this kind of information to measure things like the Hubble constants, you couldn't on a statistical sense, because the scatter is big enough that this makes it very complicated to use this kind of things for as time delay clocks.
So, excuse me. Stellar mass calculation doesn't depend on the radius?
Well, of the stellar component, it doesn't. So the total mass to light ratio does, because in the center you have only the stellar component, and then you add mass, dark mass, and so it increases. But this is the mass to light ratio only the stellar component, which is assumed to be constant.
It should be depending on the radius, because the radius is there.
Yeah, but this is a very minor correction. You know, this is about 0.3 arc seconds, so
yeah.
It would be difficult to try. But it's true. I mean, there's probably some tens of percent.
Okay.
10-20% effect there, but we're happy with the average. And this is the formal constraint you get on the inner slope of dark matter halos. So one is NFW, 1.5 is Moore. And you see that for an isotropic pressure tensor, the individual lenses don't give you very good constraints, and the combined probability distribution function. So it's sort of consistent with any density up to Moore or so. But of course, if you were to think that your pressure tensor was radially anisotropic, you would need to have much flatter dark matter density profiles, something like here. So in order to reconcile this kind of observations with, say, typical CDM predictions, you have to assume that baryonic collapse does not steepen your mass distribution very much, and the pressure tension, so it's not strongly radial.
Sorry, you have both of the green and the blue and the chum.
These are the individual lenses. And the dashed line is the product of all these probabilities. So I realize I'm going rather fast, but please feel free to interrupt me in any moment. So let me draw some conclusions from this. Well, okay. So we can measure the mass distribution of very tight galaxies out to redshift 1. We detect dark matter halos. This is good for CDM. Yoo-hoo! The total mass density profile is approximately, say, within 15% in the logarithmic slope, isothermal. I don't know if this makes sense with CDM simulation. It's probably too difficult because you have to take into account all the baryonic collapse and all that. But it's something, you know, that eventually it would be nice to have an explanation on why it's happening. Spatially resolved data are inconsistent with strong tangential radial anisotropy. I think I saw a paper by Ben Moore, a collaborator today, on the anisotropy that you get from numerical simulations. So this is something that might not be too far off in the future, although, as always, variance are a problem here. And linear slopes are consistent with, say, 1 and 1.5, only for no steepening during baryonic collapse and isotropic orbits. So I would say there's no reason here to criticize CDM at this point. Now, I told you there's only 11 lenses known to man. I lied. Because since we realized we were sort of short of lenses, we came up with an idea to find new lenses that were suitable for our study. The problem is that the traditional searches for gravitational lenses are no good for us. Sloan, for example, tends to pick up quasar pairs or things that have extremely bright background sources. So that doesn't work well for us because we want to study the lens. So what we did, and this is in collaboration with these guys at MIT, Leon and Maxim Sakis, is Adam Bolton, for his PhD thesis, looked through the entire SPSS data release 1 and looked at all the spectra of luminous red galaxies and looked for emission lines that do not match the absorption line redshift. So this is a lens. It's an elliptical galaxy at some redshift, 0.2. And these emission lines are at a different redshift. And these are clearly detected. This is O3, and this is H-theta. All right? So you have emission lines that do not match the absorption line. There's an object in the background. And this is perfect for us, because the background object cannot be too bright. In the fiber, there's only enough light to get this emission line. All right, so he came up with 49 candidates from Sloan, data release 1. And we estimated a success rate of about 40% based on the ratio between the area of the Sloan fiber and the expected Einstein radius. And so we were approved an HST program to look at these targets in snapshot mode. Snapshot mode is a very cool mode when you use gaps in the HST scheduling program to take very short exposures. So we take 7 minutes in B and 7 minutes in I. One single exposure per lens. And this is what you get. These are the first 9 lenses that were observed since August. And the top 5 are clearly Einstein rings. Here, the lens has been digitally removed in a sort of a crude way. And you can see this is a cusp configuration. This is almost a perfect ring, another ring, another ring, another ring. There were only a few rings known before this. So far, 17 targets have been observed. We have confirmed 10 out of 17. So we are well above the success rate, we hope, when we started this program. But we have already doubled the number of suitable lenses for this thing.
How big is the Sloan fiber in the kitchen?
So it's 3 arc seconds, the Sloan fiber, and I would say it's about this. Typically, the Einstein radius is inside the Sloan fiber. And this is the first lens we observed. And this is the B band image and the I band image. And once you remove the galaxy, you clearly see 4 images here. You might not believe this, but this is a Magellan IFU image. This is taken with Magellan. This is practically an image at the wavelength of the emission line of the background source. And you can see the beautiful configuration in the emission lines, exactly identical to this. So then we did a lens model. This is the residual here. And this is the model. This is a source sitting inside the plastic, producing 4 images. And this is the residual. So this is submitted to FJ Lecter. We got the free report. So this was the first in the series, and we hope to have soon a more detailed release of this collaboration data. Stellar mass. All right, so let's move down in scale from the halo to the stars. How do we do this? Well, first, let's pick out a sample of early type galaxies. These are morphologically selected early type galaxies in Goode's North. It's about 160 of them, sorted by redshift, so from 0.1 to 1.2. This is in collaboration with these people and sort of an external collaboration with these two. So we went to Keck and we spent 5 nights looking at these objects for hours and hours and hours and hours. And this is the kind of signal to noise you get as a function of Z-band magnitude. So you go from about 100 to somewhat below 10. This is an example of a spectrum. The black one is a spectrum. And the red one is a stellar template that's been used to measure the velocity dispersion of this galaxy. And so you can see you can obtain a pretty precise measurement of the velocity dispersion. And this is the faintest and most distant galaxy for which we have measured velocity dispersion. 1.1, pretty accurate velocity dispersion, signal to noise of 9. So out of this, we have about 140 early type galaxies for which we have dynamical mass. And you can use this dynamical mass to construct the fundamental plane and measure the offset from the local relationship, which is expressed here in units of delta log m over l. This is the difference in mass-to-light ratio with respect to what you would expect for a local early-type galaxy, all right? And now, the size of these symbols, it's an indication of how massive these guys are. So the big symbols are about 10 to the 12 solar masses, and you go down in mass and so on. And these curves are what you would expect for a single burst stellar population formed at redshift 5, 2, or 1. Right? What you see is that for the massive guys, we find that their stellar populations are old. They look like old red and dead galaxies, just passively evolving between 5 and now. As you go down in mass, there's this whole slew of, say, less massive galaxies. They seem to be way above the prediction for an old stellar population. And of course, these are single burst stellar populations, so you need not to have all the stars formed at redshift 1 to be here. It is sufficient to have, say, 90% of your stars being very old and then having had a burst in the last giga year to go up like this. All right? So this is the kind of scenario you can use to explain this.
Gamma here is a slope again?
No, sorry. This is delta gamma. It's the changing the intercept of the fundamental plane. This is what you measure, and this is how you interpret it. So I like to plot it this way, but you should just look at this. The delta log m over l. And this is a confirmation of what you see in terms of stellar population versus mass trend. So I plot here mass to light ratio versus color. And you see that the highest mass light ratio and also the reddest color, which is what you expect for an old stellar population. So the mass to light ratio correlates very well with this independent measurement of the ages of stellar population. And this line here is what you expect for a single burst Brousoir-Charlot model, blah, 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 going from 12 giga years to 0.5 giga years. And this is not a fit. There's no free parameters. This is just overplotting the thing on the data. So there's a clear trend with age. And this is just to quantify a little bit better what I said regarding mass dependency of the stellar population indicators. So here I plot as a function of mass, dynamical mass, the offset from the fundamental plane evolution that you find in massive galaxies in clusters. So massive red galaxies in clusters are sort of the oldest and baddest galaxies you can find. And here I measure the offset. So something that is negative here is something that has a smaller mass-to-light ratio, so there's younger stellar populations. So when you go to high masses, your mass-to-light ratio evolution is identical to those of massive galaxies in clusters. When you go to smaller masses, you see this whole, say, bunch of galaxies at a much smaller mass for light ratio. Of course, this is in part due to selection effect. When you go to small galaxies, you don't see them here anymore. So this sort of triangle here, this should be a triangle like this. And then this part is wiped out by selection effect. But there's this wedge going all the way down, which you don't see here, which means that when you go to smaller mass systems, you have a younger component of stars. And just to give you an idea of how you can reproduce this thing, here I take the dynamical mass and I put an I take this mass and I say this is the stellar mass. Let's assume for a moment this is the stellar mass. Everything scales with it anyway. And I add a younger component, 1 giga-year-old, 10 to the 9, 4 10 to the 9, or 16 10 to the 9. And this is what you obtain. When you go on the high mass guys, adding a satellite of young stars, for example, doesn't do you much. But when you go to smaller and smaller systems, it is sufficient to add that kind of mass in young stars to change significantly your mass light ratio. And so the picture here that seems to emerge is that the most massive galaxies are just red, old, and dead, even in the field, while the least massive galaxies seem to be in a process of continuous accretion, either of smaller satellites or continuous star formation for some reason, or even mergers, because when you go down to 10 to the 10 down here, this is a significant fraction of the mass, right? And this is confirmed, for example, even by spectral features. Here you can see this is H delta, and it's much stronger for the low mass guys than for the high mass guys. And H delta is a measurement of the young star population, about a giga year old. Now, the question is, do we see any trend at all with the environment? So how do you measure the environment? The way we chose to measure the environment is similar to what is done in other surveys. It is we find the five nearest neighbors, and we can count the density inside that region. It's kind of complicated because we have to deal with incompleteness, some photo Z, some spectroscopic Z. So to convince you that this procedure works, here I show high density point early type galaxies, medium density early type galaxies, and low density early type galaxies in this redshift slice. And all the black points are just galaxies that for spectroscopic Z or photo Z are at the same redshift. And you see that the method seems to work. You pick out in blue the high density regions. So the blue is finding high density regions, while the red are found mostly in isolated or less, more isolated galaxies. And this is good. And this is also what we would have expected based on completely different lines of evidence. Blue is found in the high density region, and red is generally found in the low density region, with some exceptions, of course, but hey, that's Texas. What can you do about that? All right. So once you've measured the environment, you can plot your offset from the cluster fundamental plane as a function of environment, which is local density. And you can see there's at best a very marginal trend. Those of you who have followed me throughout this might realize that the clusters should be at zero. Massive galaxies in clusters should be at zero. So there's still a residual difference between the field and cluster. However, this could also be explained by the fact that they have different mass functions. Early type galaxies in cluster have a mass distribution which is skewed toward higher masses than the field. So the ideal thing would be, of course, to do this in two-dimensional space, looking at dependence from mass and density at the same time and see what happens. This is done in Sloan. The higher redshift would not have the same statistic yet.
Why are you assigning your error function?
To what?
These
yes, so this is the scatter in the bin. This is the big one. It's just a scatter inside each bin in density of all these points. And the small error bars are just the uncertainty on the mean. So one is the RMS, and the other one is 20 points. So it's smaller than that. And the error bars on each of these points are, say, 0.1.
All these objects have different luminosities. They're averaging over sort of a different range.
So what I'm saying is neglecting the difference in... So I construct something that should be more or less independent of redshift. That is the deviation with respect to the evolution of an old stellar population. The first order, this is independent of redshift. And then say, let's neglect mass dependency. And let's see if we can find a trend with local density. and I don't. So probably the points that are up here would be more massive galaxies. The points that are down here would be less massive galaxies. So to summarize, it appears at this stage that mass, not environment, is a key variable that determines stellar ages. In some sense, it varies with the standard CDN predictions, the old ones, say, by Kaufman and Diatel. I don't know if things have changed because there's some extra physics that can be put in there to change this kind of prediction. And massive very tight galaxies form their stars at very high redshift. So if they form by mergers, the latest mergers must be not associated with star significant star formation. Or it'd be so much, so long ago that this doesn't matter anymore. And so, or there must be some feedback or other mechanism that suppresses star formation when you go above some sort of threshold in mass. On the other hand, smaller mass galaxies form a significant fraction of their stars at lower redshift. So they keep forming all the way down to redshift 0 almost, or 0.5 or something. And this is, I think, sort of an incarnation of this idea of downsizing. And I don't know, and you guys are better than me at telling this, whether this is compatible with hierarchical models or not. All right, let's go to the last part of the talk, which is supermassive black holes.
So you said that not children in my knowledge.
Sorry?
Knowledge, of course, we are.
What did they do?
The lower redshift, mass investigation is much higher in a higher density region.
But you would expect the same even back in time, wouldn't you?
Yeah, so it's fine.
I think it's kind of flat and slow on too.
Okay.
Yeah. If you look at Bernardo's paper on the early type galaxy in Sloan, I think what they conclude is that there is a marginal trend in mass-light ratio versus environment, but they say that can be explained with just a different mass function. So the same thing we see in high action. Supermassive black holes. All right, so let's go back to this plot. These are the two determinations from the local universe. Most spherical galaxies in the universe host a supermassive black hole at their center, and the velocity dispersion of the host galaxy correlates very tightly with the mass of the supermassive black hole. Some people say this is consistent with no intrinsic scatter. Some people say there is a little bit of intrinsic scatter. In any case, it's a very tight correlation. And this is disturbing because you can think about it this way. If you define the dynamical sphere of influence of your black hole, which is the radius at which sort of something orbiting around the black hole would be perturbed in this orbit significantly. For a typical size spheroid and black hole, this is of order, say, between 0.1 and 10 parsecs. The size of the spheroid is of order kiloparsecs. How is it possible that the black hole knows about the spheroid and vice versa? They cannot talk after the fact is done. This is something that needs to be sort of imprinted in the way these are formed or evolved. And this is even more remarkable if you think that black holes and galaxies are not dead animals. Black holes accrete mass. If you have a typical black hole of 10 to the 7 solar masses, which accretes at this rate, they can significantly change their mass in a giga-year time scale or so. And if spheroids evolve by mergers, they change their mass too, and the velocity dispersion too. So it is kind of remarkable that at the end of the day, everything ends up with the same correlation. So the questions we would like to answer on this particular subject are, why is the relationship so tight? When was it formed? Was it like this all the time, or was it much bigger scatter when you go back in time? Precisely, how does this relation evolve with time? And if we can measure how this evolves with time, we can, in a sense, have some observational constraints on how the relative process of formation of supermassive black holes and galaxies are related to each other. Sometimes you can think about this in terms of a chicken and egg problem, right? Is it the spheroid that grows around the Seebeck black hole, or is the gas that is in the spheroid, which is a finite quantity, that ends up in the center feeding the black hole and terminates the mass of the black hole to what it should be, given the size of the halo you started with? Right, so if we go back in time, the two sort of simple models give us completely different behavior. In one model, for a given black hole mass, you find smaller and smaller velocity dispersion. In the other one, you find the opposite. And this could be mass dependent and so on. The problem is that it's very difficult to measure this relationship at higher redshift. Because if you take standard cosmology, 1 arc second at redshift 1 corresponds to about 8 kiloparsecs. So there's no way we can, you know, spatially resolve this sphere of influence of the black hole. So what we need to do, I think, is use active galaxies. However, the problem is that if you use active galaxies, in distant galaxies, you cannot split the light from the nucleus from the light from the host galaxy. So you get all this pollution. You know, what helps you get the mass of the black hole risks completely spoiling your stellar spectrum to measure any property of the host galaxy. So what you have to do is find just the right combination of AGN and stars, which are secret ones. Secret ones are a kind of AGN that has more or less, in the integrated spectrum, comparable amounts of stellar light and AGN light. And so in this kind of spectra, you can do both measurements at once. And there are two ways you can get the black hole mass from an AGN in the distant universe. The first one is what is called the reverberation mapping. And maybe, can I use the blackboard for a second? So the idea here is as beautiful as it is difficult to put in practice. So let me summarize quickly the idea. So you have your black hole and some accretion disk or something that is emitting light, and you're here. And there's some gas here, which we call the Brodolane region. And some of the light bounces off the Brodolane region and gets to you. Now, oops, the emission from this continuum emission changes over time. So the signal is variable in time. If you measure the time delay from between the emission in the continuum and the emission from the ions in this ionized region, you have the travel time here, and so you have the size of the Brodolane region. And that's exactly what you want. And you can do this in a non-resolved spectrum, because you have your AGN spectrum, which is a continuum plus a Brodolane. This will change over time. After some time, this will change as well. And so you measure the time delay, and you have this size. Then you need a kinematic measurement, but the line profile gives you some integral of the velocity distribution of this object. So you monitor a distant AGN, no matter how distant that is. This is about, say, a week to a month. It's relatively easy to measure the time delay. You get the mass of the central black hole. This is clean and direct. The problem is it's really a pain in the neck to do in practice, because you have to monitor these things for a long time, hope that they vary, and then get the time delay. So there's a shortcut. Can we go back to here? The shortcut is using what I call empirically calibrated photoionization method. And I explain this a bit later on. This is basically an empirical calibration of the luminosity properties of the AGN to go from the luminosity to the size of the Brodolane region using some empirical calibration based on the reverberation mapping. And then velocity dispersion, you take this integrated spectrum, you look for parts of the AGN emission that are flat and clean, and you look at the tiny stellar features on top of that and you measure the velocity dispersion. So let me go through this. Of course, this is difficult. So you want to put yourself in the best possible condition that you can. So you have to choose the redshift where this becomes as easy as it can be. So this is a complicated diagram. You probably don't need to look at this. That explains what is the observed wavelength of important features to do this method as a function of redshift. And red and blue are bad areas. You want clean areas, all right? The first clean window is this one. And by clean window, I mean this. You need to apply this method, you need at least H-beta or 3 magnesium triplet. This is a sky emission, this is a sky transmission. At this particular redshift, 0.365, magnesium falls in a clean region of the sky, O3 and H-beta fall in clean region of the sky. This does not happen very often. There are only a few magic redshifts where this happens. All right? So this would not have been possible without Sloan. So I went through the entire Sloan archive, and I selected secret ones at just about the right redshift, 0.36 plus or minus 0.01. And so out of data release 1 and 2, there are about more than 100 of those. Can you believe this? This is pretty amazing. So you can go there and say, I want this particular wrench. And it gives it to you. So then I threw away the ones that are the strongest iron bump because it's difficult to do the measurement there. And I had 5 nights at Keck so far, but we had a hurricane, we had everything, so only 1 night was good so far. So 15 objects. And 13 have been fully analyzed, and 7 were good enough to give a measurement. So let me go into a bit of detail on how I do the measurement. This is the AGN spectrum, the black line, all right? This is H beta, this is O3. And this red region here is zoomed in here. So if you take this and zoom in, expand the Y scale, you see all these lines. These are not noise. These are stellar features. This is magnesium and this is iron. And this, you can see here where I also plot the error bars. These are significant features. And the red line is a local K giant redshifted to the redshift of the host galaxy and broadened to match the best fitting velocity dispersion. And you can see that all the features in the K giant are there in the high redshift spectrum. This is another example. So this is the empirically calibrated photoionization method. It's basically, people have measured the size of the broadline region with reverberation mapping methods and have shown that this correlates more or less with this luminosity of 5100 ENSO. And the correlation here is not great, and here is not great, but I'm in this regime here. So I think it's, based on what we know, it's kind of a sensible thing to do. I'm also doing reverberation mapping, but it takes years. So eventually we'll have a second independent measurement of these black hole masses, but not now. So then you go and you do spectrophotometry of these objects, and you can do pretty good spectrophotometry. Then you measure the width of H beta, removing the narrow component, which is not variable with time. It's shown here how you do this. And finally, you put all of this together and you obtain the black hole mass velocity dispersion relationship at redshift 0.4. So these lines are the local relationship from Merritt and Ferrarese in Tremaine. The open points are AGNs, secret ones, in the local universe, and the solid points are secret ones at redshift 0.4. I must say that I was shocked when I saw this, because I didn't expect any evolution, honestly, in 4 giga years. 4 giga years is not a lot of time, and it's not particularly sort of active life, part of the life of the universe. But as far as I can tell, the measurements are correct. Of course, there can be a lot of problems. There can be that there's selection effects going on, because the way you do the measurement, you don't do it. It's just a very small sample. The photoionization method calibration might be different in the distant universe. So I would like you to take this really with caution. However, if this is true, this means that for a given black hole mass, 4 giga years ago, the host bulge had a smaller velocity dispersion. So if velocity dispersion, in a sense, means mass, for a given black hole mass, the host spheroid was less massive 4 giga years ago.
If you did an analysis of the statistics of your pick, there's a large uncertainty.
Well, especially at this point here, it's kind of deviant.
Yeah, and if you ignore the lower points, I'm just going to argue that there's no, that but even if you just take it at face mm-hmm. value, you know, the statistics of it, mm-hmm. you get more uncertainty in the slope of that line.
So I didn't even try to measure the slope of this line because I don't think I did have enough information. All I did was assuming the slope did not change, which means the evolution is not mass dependent. I did the statistical test to see whether the 7 points are consistent with this line or consistent with something more here. Okay, that's what I did. So taking into account error bars on both variables, the probability that these 7 points are drawn from this line is only 3%. It's 3%, which is not zero. It's 2 sigma test. If you remove this, it goes even further down. It's the 1 sigma test. So that's why I'm trying to do more objects and better measurements. And I, you know, I really urge you to consider this as a sort of a first step. It's not the final answer. And also, you know, if you want to be really critical, there's lots of selection effects. Since when I was doing this, it was right after a hurricane, I had to cut short all my integration time. So I couldn't go very deep down the luminosity distribution of these objects. And since I used the luminosity to predict the black hole mass, effectively I had a cutoff at small black hole masses, so I have a cutoff around here. And also, I don't span that big a range in velocity dispersion because it can be more difficult to measure small velocity dispersion than bigger ones. So also in this sense, we have selection effects more or less here and there. So this needs a lot of more work before one can go out and say, ooh, there's a rapid evolution of bulges and black holes were formed first and then bulges grew around them. But I think, you know, this is promising because this was just one night of CAT in practice. And so this can be done much, much better. I just finished doing 20 nights of sleep to do a first reverberation mapping campaign. So one can get a complete independent determination of the black hole mass, hopefully in the future. So this can improve a lot. So I think this is the first step.
Is there anything strange about that 1 point besides?
It's the smallest. I'll show you in the next slide. I mean, it's the smallest velocity dispersion and the biggest relative uncertainty. So it is possible that it's. When you measure velocity dispersion and you go beyond some limit, you might become biased. So it's not that your errors explode at some point. So I don't think this is happening from this, but the signal noise is really at the limit. So my plan is to go and give it at this point much higher signal noise. Now, after I submitted this paper, it was accepted. I started getting HST images of these objects. And I was really scared because I was like, what am I going to find? And this is the first 18 objects in the program, say the last 2 months they got in. And, you know, some of you might notice something. This is 18 spiral galaxies. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Maybe 6. Show some sign of interaction of some sort of disturbed morphology. If you take a similar sample of Seyfert in the local universe, it's only 1 out of 10. So this is a third of them.
So why are they all spirals? That's
typically, Seyfert ones are bulge-dominated spirals. That's the typical. Because if you have a real massive galaxy, the black hole is so big that it's a quasar. And you couldn't do this measurement because it would just be completely swamped by the quasar light. So you see there are bulges here. So this is the deviant point. Well, you know, looks like a normal galaxy to me. However, the problem is that when you have what I have, that is an integrated spectrum, you're basically integrating along one direction, also the line profile. So if there was, say, significant rotation in some direction, and what I'm doing is assuming they're pressure-supported systems, so I'm just fitting for the width of the line. If your line profile is not just a Gaussian or something like that, if it's something with horns or something like that, and you try to fit it with a Gaussian, you can get an odd result. to another. These are not too small. They're about, these postage stamps are about 7 or 8 arcseconds on a side. So with an integral field unit with adaptive optics, one can get two-dimensional velocity fields. So that's another possible explanation for this, that from the integrated spectrum, you're not getting the right measurements of velocity dispersion. However, I must say that this interaction rate was quite surprising, only at 0.4. So it is possible that when you select active galaxies, you are sort of biasing yourself towards a class of spirals that are more active in star formation sense as well in growth sense than the your general population. So hygiene activity and star formation activity and mergers can be somewhat
related. So I guess these bodies will grow, but I guess.
Yeah, so I mean, it could make sense with what I told you before,
right.
I hope.
Well, this is
yeah, this is. So let me summarize, because I'm running out of time. I think it is possible to measure black hole mass and sigma energy greater than zero. 0.4 is only the first step. We can take it further. And for the first sample of Seyfert 1 and 0.4, about 40 years ago, we find that the fixed black hole mass corresponds to smaller spheroid mass. And so I conclude that bulges of active spirals appear to have evolved significantly in the last 40 years. Consistent, perhaps, with the high interaction images, but all of this is just first attempt. And coming up on this program, I just finished on November 3 my reverberation mapping campaign at LIC, so I hope to get at least some of the masses from the reverberation mapping. I hope I've submitted a proposal to the UC TAC to finish the velocity dispersion and photonization method measurements. And the HST imaging of 20 galaxies is almost finished, so I hope that within a year or so there will be much more robust measurements of all these quantities for the first sample of 20. And hopefully, if things go well, after 2005 we can go to higher ranges and see what happens in the next episode. Yes, okay.
When you look at X-ray observations, can you draw a consistent picture with what you find?
In what sense? Which one of the topics?
The bulges are just growing as a bit higher, velocity is going down, but you have black hole mass.
I don't know.
Any evidence of such along the same line from the X-ray observation?
So you try and get the black hole mass from the X-ray emission, and then sort of. The problem is that you don't have a velocity dispersion of the host. And most of the galaxies from which you get X-ray emission and high redshift are really powerful AGN, so it's very hard to get any information in the host.
Even if you go down to low velocity region, you can't do
the. I don't know. I haven't looked at it carefully enough, but it might be useful cross-check. I know there's a work by Shields where they look at more massive AGNs, and they use the width of all three to estimate the bulge velocity dispersion. And then they use the same method as I do to get the black hole mass. And they find a gigantic scatter, but they find practically consistently no evolution on the way up. So this could be due to two things. One is that the more massive systems, once again, formed earlier. And at least massive ones are still doing things now. And the other explanation is that the width of all three is not actually a good measurement of stellar velocity dispersion, because the width of all three also includes non-pressure components, like if you have streaming motion or wings or non-equilibrium things, this will broaden your O3. And you can see your O3 profile is never symmetric, it's always kind of asymmetric like this. So it's clearly not purely a measurement of the velocity dispersion. And for my objects, I have both O3 and stellar velocity dispersion, and I can see that O3 is skewed toward bigger velocity dispersion than the stellar component. So I think there's a problem there too. But that might be the only way you can do the highest mass objects, of course. So.
There's one data point from Sloan where they found they find the bulges too small as well.
They find the bulges too small?
The CO line is.
Okay.
The highest ratio for the above.
And the final above is so small.
Thank you.